Let's hit it.
And welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm so excited that you're joining us today. We are going to have a fascinating conversation, as usual, as we learn from people all around the world at all ages and stages of life. Stay tuned as we shift our dementia care from crisis to comfort.
All right, here we go. What you think about?
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome back to Alzheimer Speaks Radio. We are going to have a fascinating show for you today. We're going to be discussing the new book, Finding the Right Words, with author Cindy Weinstein, and she is also a professor, and Dr. Bruce Miller. And before I introduce them, like always, I want to give a few shout-outs. So first of all, we probably have some new listeners, and they might not even know what Alzheimer's Speaks is about. And bottom line, we are about sound news, not just sound bites. We want to have real conversations and raise the voices, big and small, all around the world. So maybe, just maybe, you can be our next guest. I'd love to hear from you. Everyone is welcome here. And if you liked our opening music, it's called Clarion Call by the Mark Arneson Band, and you can download that on any of your favorite music platforms. I am still working with Arthur's Senior Care, and so we are doing virtual memory cafe the second and the fourth Wednesday of each month at 1 o'clock Central Time. Anyone is welcome to join that. Also, we are doing an in-person group with Brookdale North Oaks here in Minnesota at the Shoreview Community Center, and that is the last Wednesday of each month at the Shoreview Parks and Rec Center. You can just go to my homepage or email me at radio@alzheimerspeaks.com for more information. And of course, I would be amiss if I didn't mention Dementia Map, our global resource directory that we continue to build out each day. It's been really fun seeing that expand. So check that out. It's free to use. You don't have to sign in with an account at all. It's very, very simple. We want to make sure that the people using it, which are people living with dementia, their families, as well as professionals, that we don't slow them down and we make connections simple and easy for them to access with our 150 categories and calendar of events and much more there. So check out dementiamap.com. I also want to talk to you about Picnic Health. You see, you can now join an important Alzheimer's disease research project in minutes from your home. Go to picnichealth.com/speaks and sign up, and you'll actually receive $25. Picnic Health collects and digitizes all of your medical records into one online account, and then you can consent to share anonymized data of your records with medical researchers. And by examining this real-world data from people's medical records, researchers can find answers that they couldn't find in clinical trials. So it's really important that they gather this unique healthcare journey information to expand our knowledge base. So feel free to share your story. Again, you go to picnichealth.com/speaks and get your $25. And if you're caring for someone with dementia, you can sign up on their behalf as long as you have legal consent to do so as well. We are going to hear from the Footbar Walker, and then we're going to be right back with our guests.
Introducing the life-changing Footbar Walker.
I'm Peggy from Danville, Kentucky, and I'm 91 years old. The Footbar Walker revolutionized my care of George. The saving that I made from having to put him in a nursing home came to about $192,000. The Footbar Walker opens and closes just like a standard walker. The only thing that is different is the top bar and the foot bar. Does that ever make a difference?
Does someone you love use a walker? Do they struggle to get up from from a seated position? Are you a caregiver dealing with physical pain and stress as you help your patient? The Foot Bar Walker was designed to assist not only the patient, but also the caregiver. Patients have more control standing up, and no lifting from the caregiver is required. See how it works at thefootbarwalker.com. That's thefootbarwalker.com. Peggy, would you recommend the Foot Bar Walker?
Do I ever? I would not be in the health that I'm in today at this age had it not been for the Foot Bar Walker.
I absolutely love that walker, and I personally highly recommend it. It really does reduce injuries and allows people more independence and dignity in their mobility. Now, let's go ahead and introduce our guest today. We first have Professor Cindy Weinstein, who is a graduate student from UC Berkeley. And her father, Jerry, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease. He was 58 years old, and he passed away 12 years later, unable to read or write or speak. So the question is, how does one really deal with loss after loss at such a young age? For decades, Cindy had struggled with that, just coming to terms with her dad's journey. But her healing actually began when she wrote this new book called Finding the Right Words. Cindy, welcome to the show today. How are you doing?
I'm good, Lori. Thank you so much for inviting me and Bruce.
Well, I'm excited to have you both here. I've been on this journey myself. I haven't put it into words, but I know for me, just talking about things has really helped. But let me go ahead and introduce Bruce, and then we'll get into our line of discussion here. So Dr. Bruce L. Miller is the A.W. and Mary Margaret Clausen Distinguished Professor in Neurology at the University of San Francisco, California, and he is also the director of the Memory and Aging Center and the coordinator of the Global Brain Health Institute. And I'm just thrilled to have you both with us today. You both are distinguished colleagues. And Bruce, welcome to the show. How are you?
Great to be here today, Lori. Thanks for having us both.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. But before I kind of go into my line of questions, I always like to give my audience just a little baseline. And Cindy, I had mentioned that your dad had early onset, but did you have anybody else in your family or circle of friends as well that was diagnosed with a form of dementia?
One of my dearest friends from college, her mother developed Alzheimer's much later in life, and it looked very different from the dementia that my father had. I'm pretty sure, although there was never a diagnosis, that my grandfather on my father's side had some kind of dementia. I talk a little bit about that in the book, but there was never a diagnosis of dementia. And I have many friends and colleagues at Caltech with parents who have been diagnosed with dementia. It's ubiquitous.
Yeah, it really is. What can you just tell our audience, what were some of the signs that your family saw regarding your father's dementia early on?
Sure. One of the things that I should say at the outset is that I was in Berkeley finishing my PhD program when some of the earliest symptoms that my father experienced presented themselves. And I would often visit my parents in Florida and see some of the symptoms, but a lot of them were over the phone and in letters that my father would type to me. So the initial symptoms that I glimpsed were related to language. And my father, in conversations with me on the phone, couldn't really put together a sentence we would talk and his answers would be monosyllabic. And I couldn't really understand why that was the case. I was extremely close to him. We talked about everything. And so the fact that he wasn't communicating very much to me seemed strange. I had chalked that up to depression, and my family had chalked that up to depression as well. I can talk more about that later. But language and word finding were the initial symptoms. Later, I observed that he had a tremendous amount of difficulty sleeping. He had always had insomnia, even when I was little, but really had great difficulty sleeping through the night. There was a symptom that I think we didn't realize very early on, decades before he was diagnosed, in what I learned is called the prodromal phase of the disease, when the disease is kind of percolating. My mother took my father to a hearing doctor. My dad was having difficulty hearing, and the results of the hearing test were that everything was fine. But the fact is that there were probably some cognitive difficulties already at work years before the actual diagnosis.
Yeah, very common. You hear that a lot. And yet you go in and you find out your hearing is normal. And then you think, well, it can't be that. But people kind of stop looking so often, I find, when I'm talking with families and things. Bruce, how about you? Have you been personally touched in your circle of family or friends by dementia?
Well, certainly I see lots of people with dementia. Close friends, family, not exactly, but I live with this almost all my waking hours as I think about people I look after and talk to and people whose loved ones are seen in our clinics.
And I would imagine the old saying, when you've seen one person with dementia, you've seen one person with dementia, stands out to be true for you from a medical standpoint?
Very much. I think I write a little bit about this in the book. But I think each one I see is different. It's really a rare opportunity to think with someone about their life, about how this illness has affected them, and talk with their loved ones as well about this. And so, for me, it's really an incredible social journey as I talk with individuals, each one of whom is unique, and each one of whom has similarities as the illness touches their brains, but also enormous variability.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Cindy, I'm wondering what made you decide to write the book, and why do it with somebody else?
Let's see. I wanted to write the book for a very long time. I really wanted to come to terms with my decision to stay in the Berkeley PhD program and get my degree, as opposed to moving back to Florida and being a primary caregiver for my father. And I was guilt-ridden for decades about that decision, despite the fact that I knew my parents would have wanted me to stay and pursue a career that I had wanted to pursue since I was very young. I always loved to read and I always loved to write. And the other reason I wanted to write the book is this terrible coincidence of studying language and literature and acquiring expertise in language at exactly the same time that my father was losing words. So those were the two reasons. I'm sure there are more, the two main reasons that I wanted to write the book. But I didn't, it took me a long time to write it for various reasons. I wasn't ready emotionally to write it until I was in my 50s. I wasn't ready to confront all of the difficult things that went into writing the book. And I didn't want to write it alone. There are a lot of fantastic books written by caregivers about dementia. I wanted to write a book that both told my individual story, but also gave the reader information about dementia, because I had this feeling, only I had known more about my father's illness, I would have been better equipped to deal with it. But it was the 80s, and neurologists, frankly, didn't know all that much about dementia, and all dementia was Alzheimer's. And so even if I had asked all the questions that ultimately I was able to ask of Bruce, I would not have gotten answers. So I wanted to write it with a neurologist who could explain to the reader the ABCs of brain health in a way that a demo reader could understand and absorb. It was really important to me that when readers picked up the book, they would get the language that they might need so that when they went to the neurologist's office, they would know what a PET scan was or an MRI. They would know what the different parts of the brain looked like. There would be a familiarity with the words. And so then the reader would be better equipped to ask the doctor the questions that needed to be asked. And I wanted to write it with Bruce because I knew that he really was a very empathic doctor. He was an expert in frontotemporal dementia and dementia more broadly. And I knew he was interested in the intersection of humanities and science. And we really hit it off when we met. And I was determined to figure out a way to write this book with him.
Okay, great. Bruce, why don't you tell how you two met and what was it about Cindy's story that led you to agree, yeah, this sounds like a good idea, let's write a book?
Yes, well, we met through a mutual friend, Ken Kosick, who Cindy had talked to about her book. And so Cindy called me and told me that she was thinking about writing a book about her father. And around the same time, we opened up our Global Brain Health Institute, which is a fellowship devoted to interprofessional people. It includes not only physicians, psychologists, basic scientists, but also artists. And we believe that these artists can tell the story of science much better than can scientists. So I suggested to Cindy that she might be interested in applying for our Global Brain Health Fellowship, which she did. And, you know, I think we had a tentative agreement to write this book, although, you know, I think it came at us very quickly. And we finished the book, I think, and really once we got started in less than 6 months. And so for me, reading Cindy's narratives was really very intriguing. It taught me so much about her and her father and literature and grief that I knew that it was very important to collaborate with her and help her tell her story in the most scientifically correct way that we could.
Okay, wonderful. Cindy, why the title? I'm always fascinated on how people pick their titles, and yours is called Finding the Right Words.
I thought long and hard about the title. The after finding the right words, it's a story of literature, grief, and the brain. It took me years to find the right words for the title, actually. What I realized is that the words that I had to understand what my father was going through were insufficient, and many of those words came from literature, and I talk about that, the way that books helped me understand in part what my father was going through and the grief that I was experiencing. But the fact is that those words from my own profession were insufficient. And so becoming a fellow at GBHI, studying neurology at UCSF, was in fact me trying to find the right words to tell the story of my father. And the words are neurological, they're literary, they're the words of a daughter's love for her father. And so writing this book really was a search to find the right words that would capture the love that I have for my father, the experience of...
Oh, we lost you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I needed to find a bunch of different languages to tell the story. And what was so powerful about working with Bruce and the amazing faculty and nurses and caregivers at UCSF is they provided me with this other language to tell the story about my father's life and my father's death.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Thank you. Let's talk about, you know, because I would imagine this whole exploration of writing the book. Cindy, I'm sure you learned some things from Bruce and vice versa. Cindy, what did you learn from Bruce, you know, to help you through this process that might have surprised you?
Well, the first thing I learned from Bruce that took my breath away was what my father actually had. Because when we got the diagnosis in the 80s, it was Alzheimer's. And one of the most powerful moments in my friendship with Bruce was when he gave me a precise diagnosis of what my father had. And he told me that it was early onset Alzheimer's, which means 65 years or younger. Early onset Alzheimer's with the logopenic variant, which means that the initial, and Bruce, correct me if I'm wrong, that the initial presenting symptom was related to a loss of language and difficulty finding words. So that was huge. And I remember saying to Bruce, like, how do you know that in the absence of MRIs and PET scans? I had called the neurologist's office in Maryland where my father had been seen, and the records were so old that they didn't have them. And Bruce said to me that he was able to make that diagnosis based on the stories I told and how I talked about my father. And that was huge. That was really huge for me to get that precision diagnosis. I learned that story about hearing was very important to tell, because the rest of the story is this. In that doctor appointment, when my mother and father were told that my father didn't have a hearing difficulty, the hearing doctor said to my mother, "How long have you been married?" And my mother said, "You know, decades." And the doctor said, "Well, he just doesn't want to listen to you anymore." And I told that story to Bruce. Yeah, I told that story to Bruce, and Bruce said, "You need to write that."
Yeah.
And I would tell Bruce stories, And so that turned into a chapter about diagnosis. I didn't know I was going to write a chapter on diagnosis. I didn't know I was going to write a chapter on behavior until I told Bruce the story of my father trying to pull the sink out of the wall in the nursing home. And Bruce, whose expertise is frontotemporal dementia, where behavior is really crucial, said to me, you need to write a chapter about your father's behavior. Bruce taught me so much, as did the entire faculty at UCSF, about dementia, about the importance of sleep. One of the things Bruce said in one of his seminars that he gave, he was talking about Parkinson's and the ferocious depression that comes with Parkinson's. And he said that depression isn't just a reaction to the disease, but is often a symptom of the disease itself. And that was really illuminating because my father's mood a great deal before his actual diagnosis, and we chalked it up to depression. And Bruce said to me and others that that could be a symptom in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other thing I would say that I learned that I would share with the audience is whatever is good for your body is good for your brain. So if you want to lose 10 pounds and you're exercising, that's great. That's good for your body, but it's also good for your brain health. And I didn't know that. I thought the brain was just something completely separate from the body. And that's been very helpful to know as well, and has changed some of my behaviors in taking care of my physical health, knowing that that would also benefit my brain health.
Okay, great. Thank you. Bruce, how about you? I would imagine with every family, there's something to be learned. But what stands out for you with Cindy's story with her father?
Well, I mean, many things. When Cindy started talking about how her father was diagnosed, I, you know, projected back and remembered what it was like in 1985 when I was still a fellow at UCLA, and remembered how badly a diagnosis was done at most places, and how people were dismissed in the way that Cindy's mother was when she complained that her father wasn't hearing things well,
mm-hmm.
which probably was a manifestation of a language disorder. And so I think that made me methodically go through sort of the advances that we have made since 1985. And it was really a learning roller coaster with Cindy, and we, you know, talked back and forth about what had changed and why it has changed, and where we are with diagnosis, which is, you know, extraordinarily advanced, I would say, compared to 1985. She made me think about language and reading and the influence that had on my own brain, and thought a lot about what it was like for someone who had trouble with reading and whose brain was not enriched. And I think to some extent this was the case with Jerry Weinstein. He was not a reader. This, I think, at least in my life, had a huge influence on who I am. I think the same is true with Cindy. But when we wrote our memory chapter together, I realized that we don't have the language yet. We don't have the science to explain why people don't remember, what aspects of memory are lost, what aspects are spared, why that is. And so I began to realize, you know, that we in our own scientific world have huge deficiencies in the way that we can communicate with people. Some of these because we just don't understand the science yet. So there were, you know, many things. And of course, Cindy's an incredible writer and bouncing back chapters back and forth with her was a huge learning experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about, you know, how much things have changed, and I have to be real honest with you. I hear from people pretty much every day how disappointed they are in the diagnosis process and how difficult it is to be diagnosed, that it can take many of them say 2 to 3 years before they get an official diagnosis. And then many times it changes, which I understand symptoms change. And I understand this is one really tricky bear to even be able to define what's going on, because it has so many different mystery symptoms. And again, not everybody is symptomatic in the same way, which has to make it even more difficult for doctors. And I think people can you know, almost, you know, live with that. They struggle with that still. But I think what is most upsetting to families, and I don't know if you see this, and you may not because, you know, of your positions and what you do, but the majority of families still say they don't appreciate the way a diagnosis is given. And I know, you know, gosh, my mom's been gone since 2014, lived with it, you know, for 30 years. When she got diagnosed, we got a letter in the mail. They didn't even meet with us. So that has changed, where most people, you know, hear about it in person. Though we know that there are some families that are never told, some people that are never told of their diagnosis. And when I talk with doctors, they say it's because, you know, there's not a whole lot they can do. But I think the most troubling for families is this feeling that there's no hope, and that most still say they're not given any resource information. And to me, that is still very troubling, because I know for our family, that was a huge loss. We didn't even know there was an Alzheimer's Association, but that is just one of many, many associations. Do you feel that the tide is turning on that, or, and I'm just hearing from one side? I feel like I'm talking with kind of all sides around the world at all different levels. But what do you see, and what do you feel on that?
Yeah. So yeah, you touch on a lot of territory there. Let me just briefly respond. So the first part is diagnosis, and I think what we've seen, and it's very new, and I think it hasn't totally been transmitted yet to all practices. But what we can do now, which was never the case before, is tell someone whether they have the bad Alzheimer proteins in the brain or not. Mm-hmm. And we can tell them where those proteins are. So with the imaging of the amyloid or the plaque, and with imaging of the neurofibrillary tangle, the tau protein, we can really tell somebody not only whether or not they have Alzheimer's disease, but how advanced it is in the brain. So that's new. And that, you know, I think is incredibly exciting and moving into clinical practice very rapidly. Even more exciting than that, I think we now have blood tests that will soon be approved by the FDA that will give us very similar information about the plaque and the tangle. So one of the things that has dramatically changed, and, you know, we said for many years we were never sure whether someone had Alzheimer's disease until they died.
Mm-hmm.
We can diagnose it during life. And so that's one huge advance. But the second, I think, advance is that we've learned that the amyloid protein begins to accumulate in the brain about 15 years before someone becomes symptomatic. And we can now diagnose that pre-symptomatic phase, again, with imaging and with blood and spinal fluid tests. So what that means, as our therapies get better and better, we will be able to intervene even before somebody is symptomatic. So I think, and nobody, I think, in 2021, moving into 2022, should ever be satisfied with a sloppy, shoddy, or incomplete diagnostic effort. And it shouldn't take 2 years. It can be done, you know, relatively rapidly, within days to weeks. So that would be one comment. The second comment is that increasingly, and Cindy and I talk about this in the book, we have learned that this is not just an illness of one person. It's an illness that affects a family. It affects the caregivers. It affects children. And, and the diagnosis must be delivered in the most sensitive possible way. So this is also something that, you know, I think we touch on in the book, how this has changed, should change. And I think if someone is not being treated with that kind of respect, then they need a different system to seek care in. And I think your point there is very important. And then the third comment about not being able to do much, I think we can do a lot. And I think there are increasingly resources that you touch on that are available to families, whether it's our website at UCSF, the Alzheimer's Association. In Minnesota, you have a wonderful University of Minnesota Alzheimer team. Rochester, the Mayo Clinics is a world-class Alzheimer program. So I think not letting people know about resources around them is really an error in diagnosis as well, and is not satisfactory anymore. And then I think Cindy touches on, we have learned that 30 to 40% of Alzheimer's disease has preventable components. So not letting the caregiver know about this, not letting the patient know that they must be exercising. They must not be socially isolated. If they have a mood disorder with the illness, it must be treated. Plus the treatments with the cholinesterase inhibitors like donepezil, Exelon patch. You know, this offers an improvement in somebody's life course. So I think we are very aggressive, not only before we make a diagnosis, but after. And I think this world is changing, and I think changing very fast.
Yeah, just in the last 5 years, it's definitely, I've seen a lot of change. I've only been in this space since 2009. But in like 2013, you know, I was involved with launching the first dementia-friendly community in the U.S. with the Lutheran Home Association, and people thought we were crazy. And now seeing the movements, the problem I still see, and Cindy, I'd love your thought on this as well, is I still see us, especially here in the U.S., as being so pillared and separated. And, you know, I loved your comments, Bruce, when you said not telling about resources is an error and that this really is a diagnosis of a family. You know, it affects everyone. And, you know, you kind of need to treat everyone in the family to keep the support system going. But I just I still see the pillars of, well, I'll give out this information, but I won't give out their information. And I just really feel that does such a disjustice to families as a whole. And Cindy, as a family member, what are your thoughts on being able to get resource information? How would you like to see that handled?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the doctor giving information is an expression of empathy. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I learned in talking with Bruce and in writing the book is just how important empathy is, and that it can take various forms, and providing the family with information, letting the family ask questions. No question is too small. No question is stupid. And providing that environment at the moment of diagnosis is so important. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Bruce and I hope for this physicians, as well as caregivers, as well as anyone sort of trying to make sense of grief. But if physicians read the book and take away the message that delivering information is empathic and creating an environment where the family feels that it's okay to ask lots of questions is just so important for the family's health and well-being going forward. And I didn't realize how damaging the way we received the diagnosis was.
Mm-hmm.
But in retrospect, absolutely. And as Bruce is saying, you know, when the diagnosis is delivered, I think it's also important not to overwhelm the family with information, but try and be sensitive to what kind of information would be most beneficial to the family. If we had heard that playing music for my father would have been helpful, he always loved Frank Sinatra,
mm-hmm.
we would have done that. If we had known that having him visit a dog park, he loved dogs, that would have been helpful for his state of mind. We would have done that. So I think if the doctor can give the family just some tidbits of very pragmatic advice at the same time as the family is absorbing this very difficult diagnosis, that would be really helpful. And also to tell the family that they shouldn't, that there are support structures in place that they can take advantage of, and that it feels very lonely, but that they're waiting in the wings to be helpful, including all the groups, Lori, that you just mentioned that you're a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's kind of like a twofold thing, you know, like giving the family the medical information that they need, but also giving them some practical things that they can do for the
mm-hmm.
toolkit. And there'll be more opportunities for the family to talk with doctors and get follow-up, et cetera, but if the physician can be really intentional about how that diagnosis event goes, I think that would be hugely helpful to families.
Yeah, even having, you know, a consultant on the team in terms of how do you build a care team, what does that even mean? You know, what does that
yeah.
look like? Or letting people know that there are caregiver coaches. There's so much that they don't know. And I still see way too often, in my opinion, that and I loved your phrase of that it's an expression of empathy, because it truly is. And yet, like the attorneys and like clinic directors a lot of times go, but it's about liability. We don't want to refer out anybody or anything that's not ours because of that. You know, we've gotten, you know, the legal beaver aspect of everything weighs in there. We've got to find some balance with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I believe, to even out the big and the small, because just because someone is a big company doesn't mean they're necessarily going to be a best fit for people. And I think people are really demanding choice now and wanting to dig a little bit deeper on their own. But let's get back to, because I can't believe we only have like 15 minutes left. The hour always just flies by, I tell you. You know, Cindy, if you had to pick one thing that you learned about dementia in your journey, what was that you think is so important for other people to know?
That's a great question. So I'm going to answer this question from the perspective of someone watching a loved one suffering with dementia. So if I'm not answering the right question, you let me know.
Mm-hmm.
But cliche to say this, but you need to let yourself feel whatever you feel,
mm-hmm.
and not pretend that it doesn't hurt. I write about trying to measure out my grief. For example, okay, how much can I lose it when my father doesn't know how to put film in the camera when once upon a time that's what you did? Because down the road, he's not going to know a bunch of other, many more important things. And so for me, I don't know if this is representative or not, but I deferred feeling the sadness for so long that it became very hard to feel.
Mm-hmm.
I know that may sound very bizarre. Tried to be rational about what was happening. And that was not a good approach, frankly. And so my advice is that if it hurts, don't pretend that it doesn't. I think if I had written, if I had kept a journal, that would have been good. My memories are very, very strong, but I think in terms of releasing my sadness, it would have been beneficial to write things down in the moment. Mm-hmm. And so that's my advice for what it's worth. It's extraordinarily hard, and it doesn't help to kick yourself or to try and kick yourself into thinking that it's not.
Yeah, I agree. Accepting those feelings, because you can't move past them if you don't sit with them, if you don't acknowledge them, and then they just stew. And then sometimes things come out sideways, or you're just not a happy person because you've got all this, you know, baggage that you haven't really, really dealt with there. And it is a difficult journey, but I think there's, I think when you move through that stuff, it's easier to find the joyful moments too. You know, it kind of frees that whiteboard. And I'm a firm believer that you're only going to find what you're looking for. And so for me, if I was busy swirling in my grief or busy trying to prevent, you know, something catastrophic that I thought was coming up and plan, you know, A through Z, then I wasn't in the moment where I could recognize joy or create joy either. And that was a big lesson for me in terms of that whole feeling approach, which I think is critical. Otherwise, you're going to drive yourself crazy, and pretty soon the inner critic's going to be driving your car, and we know that that's not a good ride usually when they're left in charge. Bruce, how about you? I'm wondering, you know, you were part of Cindy and Jerry's journey and the experience, you know, through writing the book. If they wrote their story today, let's say it you know, started a couple of years ago, how do you think that story would have changed?
Yeah, it's a great question. What an interesting question. So, you know, I think, you know, Cindy was a very sophisticated graduate student. She would be reading extensively on the internet. She probably would have gotten her father diagnosed in the most early stages of his symptoms. I think he would have probably been called mild cognitive impairment when he was first diagnosed. He would have had biomarkers performed. We know that he had subtle amounts of tau in the left temporal parietal lobe with PET. We knew there was amyloid extensively. He would have been started on donepezil or Exelon patch. And I think what I like to tell people is the studies suggest, and there have been more than 100, that, you know, this is not a cure, but that the average person who starts one of these medicines is about where they were a year later. I think they would have taken advantage of exercise programs, probably some sort of a cognitive therapy for Jerry. You know, I think they would have considered clinical trials, and although I don't think we have a powerful disease-modifying therapy yet, they're coming. I hope Jerry would have been one of the people who was entered into a study that attempted to lower both amyloid and tau together, because I think that's where much greater hope lies. And, you know, keeping my fingers crossed, and I'm speaking to a new generation of people who are starting to get sick with this illness, the new therapies and clinical trials would modify their illness. It would lower up the progression. So I think pretty different. And I think 10 years from now, we won't believe the stories that were told by previous generations. Because just like polio seemed insurmountable, impossible for a society, all of a sudden it disappeared. And I think, I hope in my lifetime, we'll see the day when these diseases disappear.
Oh, me too. You know, one of the things, too, that I you know, you'd mentioned about a powerful, you know, platform to kind of modify symptoms and stuff. You know, drugs would be wonderful. Everybody wants the magic bullet. But I truly believe one of the biggest changes that I have seen in the last, you know, 10, 11 years, 12 years has been social engagement. And people not being so isolated. I know I felt all alone as a family member. You know, no one knew what we were really dealing with. Cindy, I would imagine for you, probably the same thing. There just wasn't a conversation about this, you know, openly.
Right.
You know, people hid it. And, you know, now I see, and when they first started, people kind of pushed back at all these groups on Facebook. And, you know, there's a group called Forget Me Not and Memory People that have thousands of people, people diagnosed, care partners, professionals, all working together to support one another on, you know, options and adapting and just not feeling alone or not being able to sleep because you're worried about a loved one and you get up at 2 or 3 in the morning and you can have a conversation with someone, you know, across the pond. Who gets what you're talking about? I think that is huge. Or dementia mentors, where upon diagnosis, I would have loved that for my mom to be able to talk to someone else who's diagnosed and they could be their mentor and say, your feelings are valid. You know, I know what it's like when everybody looks at you different and treats you different. And this is what I did. This is what others do. And you see these mentees turn into mentors and the voice being raised. There's some real powerful, powerful things that have happened and continue to push forward, which I'm so thrilled to see. Or even having people with dementia talking at conferences, you know, talking to doctors, talking to professionals, talking to family, and people are shocked, like, you can talk? Because there's still that heavy stigma of end-stage disease where someone can't communicate. And so breaking down all those myths and stigmas and giving people, you know, hope through collaboration, I think is just a beautiful, beautiful message that is really starting to sprout up and people grasping a hold of really tightly because they know the difference, you know, those things are making in their lives. So I agree. I think in another 5 years, it would be interesting to have this conversation again and listen to our old one and see how far we've come along with things. Cindy, anything you want to add? We've got about 5 minutes left.
I think the only thing I would add is that in writing the book with Bruce, one of the things I realized in the course of doing that was that I was trying to model how a family member and a doctor could interact. And I realized that writing a book is different than going to the doctor's office and getting tested for dementia and getting a diagnosis. But the the collaboration with Bruce that allowed me in the final chapter, which is on memory, to remember all of the beautiful things about my father that ability to feel didn't allow me to access for a very long time. That the collaboration with Bruce is a potential way for doctors and families to think about how to work together in confronting this disease.
Yeah, because there's so much to learn on both sides from one another in this process. It's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. Well, I really appreciate, you know, both of you taking the time today. Bruce, was there anything else that you wanted to add to Cindy's comment?
Well, I think we would just offer gratitude to you for, you know, this visionary effort that you have led and the program that we are able to speak on. You know, I think this is really a massive illness. It's the most costly illness in the United States. And I think, you know, there's not enough told about it, written about it, not enough talked about. And I think what you're doing here is just critically important.
Thank you. And my goal from day one was just to shift dementia care from crisis to comfort around the world, you know, just by having a conversation. And, you know, I really feel that actually all of that I've done during this period has really been channeled through my mom. You know, her and I had such a strong connection. And by part of it, too, and Cindy, I don't know if you felt like this, but I didn't want what I went through to be for naught. I thought there's got to be a way to help others, you know, with that. And, you know, I've got a couple of books in me too, but I haven't slowed down enough to put them, you know, to paper. And it's amazing you guys did that in such a short period of time, because most people, it takes a much longer period of time to spit a book out. So kudos to both of you for doing that. Speaking of that, I do want to mention to our audience that people can go to the John Hopkins Press to purchase the book, or on Amazon. And then, of course, to your website as well. And we have those all listed on the radio page, on the blog. Everything is there. So it's just one click away. So you can go ahead and order your book, Finding the Right Words. I think it'll be not only helpful, but comforting. And to have that balance between, you know, the family version and the medical version as they merge together, you know, to support the journey, to try to make it a little bit easier for the next guy, I think is brilliant. So thank you both so much for your efforts today. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We're very grateful. Thank you.
Well, yeah. Thank you. And to our listeners, we'll be back on Thursday, and we're going to be talking with a death doula, which is part of the whole planning all of us should really be thinking about if we've got dementia or not. But we celebrate life coming in. We should celebrate life going out. And, you know, so join us on Thursday. You can go ahead always and look at some of our past shows. We just had Dr. Peter White on and Daniel George and always interesting conversations. So think about your journey. Are you ready to share it? Others would appreciate hearing it. Thanks, everyone. Have a great week. Bye now.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Suzanne Newman, host of the Answers for Elders podcast and radio show. We are the North Star that guides you through the complicated journey of senior care with trusted experts in money, law, living solutions, and more. So join us on this station, your favorite podcast channel, or just go to answersforelders.com. Meet the Wayshowers who will help your journey go a lot easier.